Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.
Outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast, your guide to the whitetail woods. Presented by First Light, creating proven versatile hunting apparel for the stand, saddle, or blind. First Light, go farther, stay longer. And now, your host, Mark Kenyon.
Welcome to the Wired to Hunt podcast. This week on the show, I'm joined by Dr. Marcus Lashley to discuss the current concerning state of wild turkeys in North America and what we can do to help slow down recent declines. All right, welcome back to the Wired to Hunt podcast, brought to you by First Light and their Camo for Conservation initiative. And today, we're taking a break from our series that we kicked off last week, which is about the culture of hunting. And instead, we are going to be discussing a different topic, which is turkeys. We're talking turkeys today because it is Turkey Week here at Meat Eater and across all of the Meat Eater platforms. That means anywhere you turn, it's going to be turkey. Go to the Meat Eater podcast, turkeys. Go to the Meat Eater YouTube channel, turkeys. Go to the Meat Eater website. You're going to see turkey hunting articles. You're going to see turkey hunting, or not turkey hunting recipes, but turkey recipes. You're going to see a turkey calling contest, actually, which, by the way, if I am somehow still in the turkey calling contest, it is a miracle, and you should vote for me just because of the novelty of somebody like me being in a turkey calling contest and actually winning it. I am not qualified. But all of this is going on when it comes to the Meat Eater Turkey Week, and that means also here at the Wired Hunt podcast, we're talking turkeys. So today, we're talking turkeys, and all this week, you probably have hopefully seen Foundations episodes with Turkey Hunt Know-How. Tony's been talking about how to kill more turkeys. And today, we're not going to necessarily talk about something that will help you kill more turkeys in the short term, but we are going to be discussing something that should help you kill more turkeys in the long term. And that's because we're talking turkey conservation. There has been a concerning decline in turkey numbers in many, many states across the country in recent years, and it's caused a whole lot of buzz about what's going on. And so today, I'm joined by Dr. Marcus Lashley of the University of Florida to discuss that very thing. What exactly is the state of turkeys today in the country? What kind of declines are we talking about? And then why are we seeing these declines? What's happening here? What's leading to many states seeing diminishing turkey populations? Is this because of habitat? Is this because of predators? Is this because of hunting pressure and things that we're doing? Is there something else going on? What the heck is happening that is causing what was at one point a huge success story when we talked about the restoration of wild turkeys? Why is this all of a sudden becoming a story of concern, a story of worry? That's what I wanted to discuss with Dr. Marcus Lashley today. And he's the guy to talk to because he is a wildlife biologist himself, and he is involved in a number of turkey-related studies. He's also a tremendous communicator about these issues because he is the host of the Wild Turkey Science podcast, in which himself and a co-host have been discussing this very topic with a number of different subject experts over the last year and really been, you know, I think, covering this better than anybody else. And he is also the creator of the University of Florida Deer Lab YouTube channel. That is an acronym, DEER, D-E-E-R. That stands for Disturbance Ecology and Ecological Restoration. And he's also founded Instagram at Dr. Disturbance. And all of this is, you know, these are all different places to find his content related to wildlife biology, wildlife habitat improvement, turkey science, deer science. He was on the podcast years ago where we talked about wildlife habitat, specifically more deer habitat. But today, turkeys is the main topic. Marcus has got a lot to share. He helps give us some solid answers, points us in the right direction on some different questions and concerns, and gives us some real substantial ideas about how we can make a difference moving forward to make sure that there are thunder chickens around to chase for many more springs to come. Because I know that's what I want. And I'm pretty darn sure that's what you want to, because turkeys are really cool. They taste really good. And I want to keep them around out there. And it's not going to be a guaranteed thing unless we are part of the solution. If we can be part of making sure the conditions on the ground are those that turkeys need moving forward. So that's the game plan for today's episode. I want to give you guys one more quick heads up before we get into the show with Marcus, and that is related to the Meat Eater Live Tour. We've got another round of Meat Eater Live events coming up here in April, late April, I believe it's starting, and this is going to be a more Western Coast, Rocky Mountain West tour. So the events will be kicking off on, let me get these dates correct here for it, April 23rd is the first show, and they're going to run all the way through May 5th. And there are going to be stops in places like Mesa, Arizona, San Diego, Anaheim, and Sacramento, California. We got a Salt Lake one. We got a Boise one, Missoula, Montana, Spokane, Portland, and Tacoma, Washington. You can get your tickets. You can learn more. Anything you need to know over at themeateater.com/events. So there's your heads up. And now let's get to our show with Dr. Marcus Lashley. All right, here with me now on the line is Dr. Marcus Lashley. Marcus, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, happy to be here. I appreciate it, Mark. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, it's been, I should have went back and seen, but it's been a good number of years since I've had you on the show last. I think when I talked to you last on the podcast was when the mineral stump thing was just kind of hitting the ground and people were really talking about that. And, and there was a lot of interest in that. I remember we had some really interesting conversations when it came to deer habitat. But you're also a turkey guy, which makes you the perfect guest for us today here, because here on Meat Eater, it's Turkey Week across everything Meat Eater this week. We're celebrating turkeys, gobblers, all the good stuff they bring with them. And you're down there in Florida these days. So I got to ask, first off, I know some seasons are open there in Florida. Have you been out turkey hunting yet?
Well, no, I didn't get drawn in several places that I put in for down in the south season. And it's the access is down there is pretty tough. Even though I work with turkeys, it's still tough for me. But I also, during the early season in particular, for example, this morning, I am basically hunting turkeys because I have ongoing research where we're tagging turkeys. And part of our research, we're actually trying to get observations of them in the field. So I'm essentially hunting turkeys and trying to keep up with them and not be known to them. And that, as you might imagine, is quite fun. It's kind of like catch and release hunting. You know, I'm getting to fulfill that same desire and also get some really cool data on turkeys at the same time. So
that's great. That's I've started to do that with my sons. So I'll take out my boys prior to turkey season opening up. And it's just like, turkey hunting with them. We just try to call on a bird for them to get excited. And that's a blast. And one year, my son, when he was, I think, three, we were out and he was carrying around an umbrella with him for some reason and pretending it was a gun. And so we actually called in three gobblers into range and he held up his little pretend umbrella gun and like talked it all through with him. He held perfectly still and those gobblers came into range. He's like, "Dad, can I take him now?" I'm like, "Yeah, go for it." And he goes, "Bow, bow." Yeah. It was the best turkey out of my life.
That's awesome.
So you know, I get the enjoyment.
He can never turn back now.
Exactly.
You've already put him on that path.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So so these studies that you're working on right now, in which you're observing and trying to, you know, have those types of interactions, what are you in particular looking at with that study?
Yeah, it's actually a multifaceted study, and we have various things going on. But in particular, we're tagging hens and gobblers on a few study areas. The primary goal, actually, of the project is just to get baseline vital rate information. So, like, you know, the typical things that people are seeing coming out, you know, across all these different projects in different states are the hen survival, nesting success, poult rearing success. And the reason that we focus on those is because it allows us to project what populations are doing, because those are the important vital rates. But there are some other interesting things going on in the turkey world related to males. And you know, typically when we model populations, we don't even include the male in it, especially when, you know, in something like turkeys or deer, where one male can potentially breed many females. It's pretty common that we would project a population, the male survival isn't even incorporated. So, you know, some of the work that we're doing now, we're trying to get that side of the coin as well, I guess, with male survival and behavior. And, you know, I have a strong interest just inherently with turkey behavior. So that's what we're trying to document, things that the gobblers that we have tagged are doing just on a daily basis, and trying to, you know, get almost like a personality imprint of what these individuals are acting like. And, you know, we have many things planned, and I don't know where it will go. It really is funding dependent and things, but that's sort of like a passion project for me, as I'm trying to get more of an idea of what the identity of the individual is. And then we can start to relate his survival and, you know, how his habitat use on the landscape is a function of, you know, his personality, which even when you capture them, you can tell, like, the individuals are individuals, just like people, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so funny. We talk about that so often with deer these days, but I've never heard that discussed with turkeys. Is that something that's been studied before in that kind of way?
That what we're doing is different than some of the previous work, but there certainly has been a lot of behavioral work, and they have looked at it from various things. Some of it is just basic biology, trying to understand what the mating system is like. Some of it is looking at what traits males, like the snood or the fan or the iridescence, you know, those kinds of traits, how females select males for to mate with. So there's been a fair amount of behavioral work, but not really looking at it from an individualism standpoint. I don't know what the right word for it that is, but like the personality of them and how that's translating into their success in their day-to-day life has not been looked at very much. And I thought it would be interesting. It's sort of a tack on to the ongoing project so that we can get some data and try to figure out, is this worth pursuing further?
That's fascinating. So is it fair to say that there has been a significant influx of attention and or funding to turkey research in the last few years?
I would say that's an understatement. Yeah. So
okay.
Right now, and I've heard some of the, you know, the turkey researchers that have been around the longest of our currently active turkey researchers, they say the same thing. Right now, we have more ongoing turkey research across the range of turkeys than ever has been the case in the history of turkey research.
Wow.
And it's not even close. So we have ongoing research programs in, I don't know how many states, but it's definitely more than 30. So, you know, wherever your listener, you know, whoever you are, wherever you're from, you probably have an active project going right now in your state, in your backyard.
Wow. So turkeys, the story of turkeys in North America.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe most people don't know this story. Could you give our listeners the 1 minute Cliff Notes version of how we got to here today? Maybe a couple minute story of how we got to where we are today.
Maybe a 3 minute. I don't know if I can do a 1 minute.
but what I really want to get at is, so I wanted that quick Cliff Note of how we got to where we are today.
Yeah.
But then part two of my question then would be, I would like to get your take on what our situation is today, as far as a, you know, if this was like a physical with the doctor and you sat down with the doctor and he's taking a look and saying, what's the health situation right here?
Mm-hmm.
Where do things stand? There's a lot of buzz within the world of turkeys right now. There's a lot of articles popping up here and there. There's definitely red flags being waved. Even the average deer hunter, I think, is aware of that. But I'm not sure they understand the detail. So could you give me the quick update of how we got here and then what is here?
Yeah. Well, it honestly it's kind of remarkable that we have turkeys to worry about, to be honest with you. When through the 1800s, we kind of had this perception that wildlife were an inexhaustible resource, and this idea that we could, you know, over harvest them, or, you know, market hunting could lead to declines, or, you know, anything like that was even possible, was kind of, you know, a weird thought back in those days. Now, you know, it's hard to believe that, but that, you know, it's kind of how it was portrayed. And we kind of got on the brink of extinction for quite a few species, turkeys being one of them. We had, almost extirpated them from a large portion of their range. And that, along with several other species, some of which we didn't save, like the passenger pigeon, it led to a series of legislative acts in the United States, and led to the North American model for wildlife management that has been extremely successful, not only in establishing sustainable use, but also recovering a lot of species. It also built financial pillars that fund that research, or research and conservation. And a lot of that is tied directly to hunting. So we have hunting licenses, we have bag limits, we have a duck stamp, we have financial pillars associated with hunting. The Pittman-Robertson Act is an excise tax on hunting-related products that then goes back into the conservation of hunted species. But what that usually entails is management of systems that then benefit many of the non-game. So the fact of the matter is, the reason we have turkeys now is because we almost lost them along with some other species, and that wasn't acceptable to people, you know, that loved the resource. And it was kind of led us to this legislation, this really successful model. And for turkeys in particular, we started restocking them pretty aggressively. We saw the birth of the National Wild Turkey Federation that was focused on restocking turkeys across the range. And we sort of went through this phase, especially in the 70s and 80s and 90s, where we had this almost exponential growth in populations across the range, especially in easterns, but in much of the range of wild turkeys. And that kind of got us to where we are now, where we had historic levels of turkeys in like the 2000s in most places. It varies some based on where you're at, but we had these really high populations, and then we started to see some symptoms of decline. And that's really led us to now, where people know what the heyday with turkeys when they were, you know, super abundant across the landscape. And frankly, I understand why it is not acceptable for them to be rare. I mean, it's not acceptable for me as a turkey hunter to go back. You know, I don't want to give up any ground. I want them to be abundant, and it, you know, to hear many gobbles every time I go hunting. You know, I understand, but we have a really passionate group of people that, you know, are concerned because there's some indicators of decline, especially in the range of easterns.
So these declines, what degree of decline are we actually seeing? Can you put some numbers on it? I've seen some pretty high numbers at state by state level. Can you speak to any of that?
That depends a lot on where you're talking about. Some states are seeing inclines. Some states are relatively stable, and others are seeing some declines that usually is over the last 15 or 20 years, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 10% to 25%, maybe on the upper end. So, you know, this slow trend of decline over time.
Okay.
Mississippi is a good example where I think they kind of, from their peak, declined to maybe 20% lower of that peak, and then it's been relatively stable for about a decade now. So, you know, it varies a lot. One thing that seems to be evident is the trend in populations in many places seem to be on a timeline that's very similar to when they were restocked.
So, can you elaborate on that?
Important implications. So, for example, some states like Mississippi were among the first to be restocked. And we see about a pattern where it's 20, 25, 30 years later where we hit this peak, and then we start to see this decline. And now Mississippi is relatively stable. Other states like North Carolina or a couple of the other ones that were really late in that restocking, where that was happening, like in North Carolina, I think it was all the way in the early 2000s, they're still inclining. Based on the state level metrics.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time: Seafoam motor treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. And it's really simple. When you pour it into your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff, like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it do its job. Now, you probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again, because people everywhere rely on it to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. So, help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something. Because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co and make sure to use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MeatEater.
So what do we read into that? Is this something that is these declines are more of like a recalibration or a resetting equilibrium? Like the initial stocking efforts happen, the population booms, and then it's maybe too high for the habitat, and then it's kind of retreating back to what that natural level should be. Is that what's happening, yeah, or something else?
So that's a great question. The initial paper that tried to address that, and it really wasn't connecting it directly to the restocking dates. I don't think they had that in the paper, but Mike Byrne was working with Mike Chamberlain and Brett Collier and a couple of other scientists, and they kind of looked at the broad scale, and they published a paper on density dependence. And that all that is a fancy term to describe what you just said. You kind of overshoot how many turkeys can be carried sustainably, and then you see a correction where density starts to negatively affect the individuals, you know, maybe through competition for resources or something. And you start to see, as you increase the number of adults, you decrease the productivity of nest or poults or survival of the adults. So there's this negative relationship between density and production. So that usually happens, or in ecology, we expect that pattern when you have some sort of carrying capacity relationship that is affecting it. But the fact of the matter is we have some competing hypotheses right now that could all explain that pattern in different ways. Okay. So it could be that we've overshot carrying capacity of habitat, but what you would expect to happen in that case is that it to relatively stabilize, like you see in Mississippi, where, you know, sort of fluctuate around some number of turkeys that can be carried. But a lot of the states were sort of seeing this slow decline. So instead of it staying stable at that level, there's this decline. So you could start to imagine some factors that could play into that, right? Well, we're developing habitat into, you know, infrastructure for people, right? We're building houses, we're building developments, we're building roads, all those sorts of things. So the amount of habitat available is declining, and it's doing that more rapidly in some areas than other areas. But if you imagine that relationship that I was just talking about, as you decrease the amount of turkey habitat available, you should decrease what that stable level should be over time. So that's one factor that has been brought up. Another factor that has been brought up is, you know, when we had that incline in all those turkeys, we also had an incline in interest in hunting turkeys. And you know, that's been proposed that maybe hunting has gotten to some inflection point that starts to drive that same sort of pattern where we'd see this steady decline because the hunting, productivity of the populations is not keeping up with the hunting pressure. The issue with that hypothesis is that if you look at the harvest rates now and compare them to what they were historically, they're the same. So that immediately tells me, okay, there's the only way that works is if hunting, you know, about 30% of gobblers on average across studies, usually about 30% of gobblers get harvested each year. So if that's a problem now and it wasn't then, why? And the reason that would be is because of productivity. So it wouldn't be that hunting is causing a decline in productivity. It would be that productivity is no longer high enough to sustain that level of harvest. So that's one hypothesis. There's various people working on aspects of that idea as well. And another one that's very popular is that we don't have as many trappers anymore, fur trappers. And, you know, as we declined our pressure on things that eat nests in particular, or eat turkeys just at any life stage, as we've declined the pressure on those species, they've inclined and become more abundant. So people think that it's, you know, blaming on predators changes. That has some issues too. I think it's really interesting to kind of unpack these things because they're also not independent of one another.
Sure.
So, for example, with the predator aspect, a real problem with that is, first of all, we have some studies showing that you can aggressively trap something like raccoons and they can recover from like a 90% decline in one season.
Wow.
So that wouldn't be a slow process like that. You know, we'd see an abrupt change in predation, and that isn't what the data suggest. But that doesn't mean that it couldn't be related to predators, because there's another thing happening. As you degrade the quality of habitat for turkeys, you increase the habitat quality simultaneously for several of their predators, particularly nest predators. So as habitat for nesting gets poorer, habitat quality for nest predators gets better at the same time. So you see how that could really affect the role of the predator, and it's actually a habitat problem in that case, because the habitat quality is declining for your target species and inclining for the non-target, and it's causing the predation problem. It's not the predator, it's the habitat, but you have the same symptom, you know, which is higher nest predation. So you know, that's the problem with that, is we want to immediately fix it by trapping predators when actually it's a symptom of bad habitat, which most people don't want to hear that, but it's true. And then there's a disease factor that comes in that's being postured. We have some new diseases that we didn't know were things, some that LPDV we think got introduced relatively recently from the poultry industry. It's been common in poultry, and we think maybe that's where it came from. So there are hypotheses related to disease, but same thing is true. You know, if you change habitat quality, it may make individuals more vulnerable to disease, and we might see fluxes, you know, associated with populations that are symptoms of some other problem. And that's what really makes it difficult to figure out. You know, they're all interrelated, and it's hard to figure out which one is actually the cause of what you see.
Yeah. So given that there's all these different factors at play, and some of them may be compounding each other, how would you make sense of what's most important or most impactful? Like, do any one of those in your mind seem to stand out as the number one culprit or the most impactful of these different challenges that might be facing turkeys right now?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, a lot of the work we are actively trying to quantify various parts of this complex thing I've laid out for you. But one thing that is very consistent, and I think it explains a lot of what we're seeing, and also is probably one of the confounding factors in all cases, is habitat. And I know a lot of people roll their eyes when they hear that, but when you look at, particularly in the South, but it applies elsewhere, if you look at the landscape changes that have occurred, and even in just the last two or three decades, for example, we didn't have Roundup-ready crops until the mid-90s. That was a substantial change in the landscape because agriculture got way more efficient, right? Mm-hmm. So we could kill a lot of the weeds in agricultural crops. Those weeds are the same forbs that I'm trying to get people to promote when they promote early succession for turkeys or other species that use it. We got really good at getting rid of those. We've also had intensification of pine plantations, and a lot of those came to mature. I should say that a different way. Many of those were, the pine plantations were started in the early 90s, and in the South in particular, those would start reaching closed canopy conditions in the early 2000s. And then for a large swath of time, we would have them be the least usable for turkeys. We have also decreased the use of prescribed fire precipitously over several, many decades through the 1900s. We have converted most of our early succession that's not in agriculture to a non-native pasture grass. In my part of the world, that's primarily bahia. If you get up into the mid-south, that's fescue. It could be brome. We've got, you know, all kinds of options depending on where you're at. But we've had this really strong conversion of areas that poults would be using. And one thing that's been really consistent in studies is that we usually see a bottleneck on productivity of turkeys, particularly in that first 2 weeks of the poult's life. They're really vulnerable. They can't, you know, when they're born, they don't have their feathers yet. They're growing really fast. They're eating exclusively insects. They're growing not just their skeleton, but also their feathers. And before they reach flight, they can't thermoregulate well, so they can die from exposure. The plant community structure is critical to provide that, you know, that buffer from the elements and predators, and provide high production of insects. You know, if you start looking at all of those things, and then what those changes would mean, for example, for nest predator abundance, we should expect things like raccoons and possums and foxes and various other coyotes, we should expect them to increase in abundance as a result of that change in plant community, because they have habitat too, right? And it's improving for those species. So to me, the factor that makes most sense that would also promote other aspects of this makes, you know, it comes down to that habitat issue. And it's not just that we are losing the amount of habitat, but the connectivity of habitat is being influenced, and also the quality of habitat. And even when you think about hunting, you know, we're still harvesting 30% of the males, but if habitat quality is poor and we have fewer nests that hatch, and then fewer of those poults that from the hatched nest survive, then we can support less hunting mortality. And that's not because hunting is the problem, it's because productivity in the population is the problem. And I think, to me, at the point we're at now with the amount of information that we have, we know that the relative role of these factors is fluctuating substantially, potentially, across the landscape. But the common denominator that is consistent is that we are very limited on net high quality nesting and brooding cover across the landscape. Every study that tries to quantify the proportion of the landscape that we would classify as high quality nesting and brooding cover, doesn't matter what state you pick, it always comes out in the single digit proportion when you add them together. So I don't know how much of the landscape needs to be high quality brooding and high quality nesting cover, but it's probably more than a single digit percentage of the available habitat in an area.
Yeah.
So
why does that when you mention habitat being the big issue. Why does that make people roll their eyes?
I don't know. Is that not what you wanted me to say? Well, you know, it's easy. I think it's I don't know. We've had this discussion before, and there's lots of really interesting ideas. But we like to villainize predators. They're competitors with us, right? Yeah. I think it's easy to point a finger that this is clearly a predator problem. And then it makes sense when you look at the studies, and pretty much in every single study, the leading cause of nest loss, the leading cause of poult loss, the leading cause of hen mortality is always predation. And then people look at that and say, oh, well, clearly predators are the problem. And the problem with that viewpoint is what that data point actually tells you is that predators eat turkeys. We already know that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
What you're not really understanding necessarily, if you're not thinking deeply about it, is what would be the outcome if, you know, if I did a study in an area and I removed or allowed the nesting cover to decline in quality substantially, we would lose more nests. Do you know why? Because more would get eaten. So if I took the same area and had high quality nesting cover available, and I just continued to add more and more and more predators, we would lose more nests, and it would be because more would get eaten. So if you see more nests get eaten, it doesn't actually tell you what the problem is. The predation could be the cause or the symptom, if that makes sense. And I think we latch on to some things that they just make intuitive sense at face value. And, you know, we have been talking about habitat ad nauseum for a really long time with a lot of wildlife management. And it's just people don't like to hear that for some reason. So I don't know if it's because it's easy for us to villainize other potential causes, or, you know, it's something that's not within the control of some people. It's something that's harder to understand sometimes. You know, we have plant blindness that's actually been quantified. There are all kinds of reasons. I really don't know, but I do think it's interesting. You know, if you take a step back, even when I work with private landowners really commonly, trying to help them, you know, develop high quality habitat for deer and turkeys. And it's really interesting to hear someone that's been around, you know, for 70 or 80 years, and they say, well, nothing's really changed here. And then we go around on their property and it's like, yeah, I remember when this field, we used to plant it by hand and I had to go out there and pick weeds out of it. And this field over here, it wasn't even a field. It used to be this, you know, this old savanna. And yeah, we didn't even have herbicides. So we used to just burn off all the brush everywhere. You know, they start naming all these different things that have changed right after they tell you nothing has changed.
Right.
And it's a really interesting thing, but I don't have the answer to that. But I do see that response often, where there's some people that they don't want to hear that this is a habitat problem.
Yeah, well, like you said, it seems to be that habitat is a limiting factor across so many different species of conservation concern. Right. And then there's all these other ancillary things that can then become kind of
compound.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And then because habitat is lacking, then these other things can become more impactful. So, like you said,
start to see their effect magnified.
Yeah.
You know, hens in poorer body condition should be, would we not expect them to be more vulnerable to disease?
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I think that you also said another key thing. If we look at species, so let's think about turkeys. I just told you nesting and brooding cover. That's essentially shrubland or shrubby structure in an understory that has an open canopy in a forest, or brooding cover, which is essentially a herbaceous dominated community that is particularly dominated by forbs not grass. Okay. The if we look at the species of conservation concern outside of turkeys in the eastern United States, and we restrict that to the species that reside in uplands like turkeys mainly do, almost every single species on the list that's in decline and of concern is associated with early succession, prairie, or some sort of broken canopy, frequent fire system.
Yeah.
All of them. Almost everyone.
Yeah, it's incredible. So many, I mean, all sorts of songbirds, pollinators, yeah. insects, so many different things seem to be trending down. And like you said, yeah. many of them seem attached to this this habitat need that,
yeah. that we're and losing. And it's not even unique to here. There was a global analysis recently that showed that guild of species ubiquitously globally was the most or those species were in the most trouble or most decline across the planet.
Yeah.
So it's not unique here. It's just things that we have started doing on the landscape tend to impact early successional communities. I mean, that's the easiest to turn into agriculture. It's the easiest to develop. It's the easiest to convert to pasture grass. You know, it makes sense why we would see, you know, those species imperiled by that. But, you know, then we turn and look at turkeys and people don't want to hear that this is a habitat issue when the bottleneck demographically for them are associated with that same, you know, habitat structure.
Yeah. Yeah. It shouldn't be a surprise, I guess, when you look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So
to me, because it would magnify all these other problems, it makes a lot of sense that it would probably be the root of the issue in most places. The problem is how do you change that at scale? That's where we're at. Like, how do we change habitat productivity for turkeys at scale to influence populations at state or regional levels? You know, that's a different problem that we're, you know, that we need to address.
So, Marcus, how do we do that? What's the solution?
Yeah, that I think one of them is awareness. So this is one place where I think the deer community has excelled, that the turkey enthusiast could take a chapter out of the playbook. And one of those is through cooperative land management cooperatives, where, you know, the deer management cooperatives are pretty common now. And a lot of them are very successful, you know, where you have many landowners getting together and they get a plan together where they're all going to collectively manage their deer under this plan. And that can be extremely successful. I think the same thing could work for turkeys. And we do not see that very often, but that's one way. You know, you could collectively decide, you know, hey, this is how many gobblers we think. Here's what we should do in terms of our, you know, our harvest. Hey, you know, we need to all try to increase the amount of brooding cover to some critical level. Hey, we need connectivity. So if I get a crew in to harvest this stand, do you think you could do this in the one adjacent on your property? You know, those kinds of things can start to move the needle more at a local scale, and then they build out from there. I've also been extremely active in the fire community, and particularly in the South. I mean, almost all of those landscapes that I've been talking about that turkeys thrive in, I mean, Mark, when you look at the historical records from various aspects, basically all of the eastern United States, nearly all of it was classified in some sort of woodland or savanna or grassland state. You know, almost none of that landscape is in that state now, but right. The reason it was in that state is because of widespread use of fire. So I think that's one tool that we are starting to implement at scale. There's barriers. People are afraid of it on private lands, for example. There's liability fears. A lot of people don't realize, especially in some of the southern states, that we have right to burn laws that help protect you from liability. We have prescribed burn associations that are popping up all over the place that are basically landowner cooperatives where they're all sharing resources and they're going and burning with each other. That's one aspect that I think is going to really help with this situation, is just getting more fire use on the landscape. That the artifact of that practice is better nesting and brooding cover for turkeys. So, you know, I think those are the kinds of grassroots initiatives that we can really start to move the needle. And if we have high enough awareness and we start to make policy changes like those right to burn laws that make it easier for people to do things, you know, that would benefit the species, you know, we start to make real change. And there are examples where groups of landowners or WMA complexes have gotten really aggressive with habitat management, and they see really great success with that, where the populations seem to flourish even though they may not be elsewhere in the state.
We've all seen plenty of gadgets and fads come and go, but here's one product that stood the test of time: Seafoam Motor Treatment. Lots of hunters and anglers know that Seafoam helps engines run better and last longer. And it's really simple. When you pour it into your gas tank, Seafoam cleans harmful fuel deposits that cause engine problems. I'm talking common stuff like hard starts, rough engine performance, or lost fuel economy. Seafoam is an easy way to prevent or overcome these problems. Just pour a can in your gas tank and let it do its job. Now, you probably know someone who's used a can of Seafoam to get their truck or boat going again, because people everywhere rely on it to keep their trucks, boats, and small engines running the way they should the entire season. So, help your engine run better and last longer. Pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. Now, a lot of you guys are familiar with the old hunting tradition of eating, you know, some organ, the heart or a chunk of liver off the first animal you kill. I had that when I was a little kid, and it was a big deal. Organ meats were always prized by frontier people who knew the importance of getting a lot of different minerals and nutrients. And as often is the case, those guys were onto something, because organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. And you can get the same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil, made exclusively from regeneratively raised, grass-fed, and finished cattle. Heart and Soil's unique freeze-drying process means all those important nutrients are trapped in, ensuring you experience every one of the benefits of nature's superfood in a clean, convenient, taste-free capsule. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And make sure to use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase. That's heartandsoil.co. Use the code MEATEATER.
So let's zoom in just a little bit. So we just talked there about scale, but let's now talk at like the individual level. So if I'm a landowner or a land manager of some kind, and I'm hearing you say that nesting and brooding cover is the bottleneck, that's our area of most need. It's also a habitat type that's disappearing across the country. It's also a habitat that's significantly important to many other species, and we don't have it. So it sounds like I need to make sure I've got brooding and nesting.
Let me add one other thing. It's also a structure of vegetation that a lot of our predators don't like.
Why is that?
I don't know. I've gotten asked that several times, but the state of the data, especially with prescribed fire, is very clear. We just we've recorded various episodes on various podcasts about this, where we've covered several studies related to prescribed fire. And like, for example, with a raccoon, if you put a tag on a raccoon and follow him around and get his home range, and then you burn a unit within his home range, you may as well made that thing a donut. He basically, in one of the studies that they did that, they decreased the use of that area up to 80%.
Wow.
Within that burn unit, even though it's right in the middle of his home range. So, you know, another study from northern Florida that had a whole bunch of different areas all across the panhandle, all the way over to the Atlantic. They looked at how likely they were to detect many of the predators of turkeys, both nest and adult predators, the mammals. And basically across the board, and including wild pigs that cause all kinds of problems, if you increase if the area that the cameras were in was not burned, and this was replicated, remember, across many sites, if the area was not being burned that the cameras were in, you were above 70% likelihood to detect all of them. And if you increase the frequency such that you were on a 2-year return interval of fire, so frequent fire, which most of Florida historically did burn every 2 years, or even more frequently in some places. If you increased it to that 2-year frequency, you decrease the likelihood of detecting a whole suite of predators from above 70% across the board to below 10% across the board. Wow. And we're talking about substantial changes in predator use. And it's not that they're that much less abundant. What happens is they get relegated to the wetland. Basically, the stream, you know, that the wet areas that are not being influenced by fire. And a lot of those species are what we'd call mesic species. They're supposed to be associated with that drainage.
Wow.
They're just not when fire isn't part of the landscape.
So fire obviously is a big part of the solution for those who can implement it.
Absolutely is, yes.
In addition to that, though, what else could a landowner or manager do to create more of this kind of habitat? So number one is prescribed fire. What else?
Yeah. So a lot of the things that we recommend for people to do to improve their deer habitat apply to turkeys. I want to make that clear, because I know that you have a strong deer-oriented audience, and I do a lot of turkey and deer work. To be clear, and I focus a lot on habitat. So practices that are opening the canopy, and especially when they're adding fire, that promote a developed understory, especially that is dominated by forbs, those practices are going to be beneficial for both species. So that can include a commercial timber harvest, or if you're in a situation where you can't or don't want to do that, it could include forest stand improvement, where you go in and kill individual trees and try to, you know, get rid of things that are unwanted, tree species you don't like, and do that in a way that promotes higher sunlight penetration. Other things that I think the deer community in particular can have a major impact, if you're also interested in turkeys, is starting to manage your fall food plot program such that it turns into a high-quality poult-rearing program during the spring.
Yeah, I saw some videos you guys published about that. Can you describe how exactly we could do something like that?
Yeah, so in my experience, this works really well, particularly with crimson clover and wheat, but it can also work well with like arrowleaf clover and oats or rye, cereal rye, you know, some combination of those. And you could even have four or five of those species I just named in there. But those tend to work really well. And basically, let's just keep it simple with crimson clover and wheat. So if you plant, let's say, 20 pounds of crimson clover per acre and maybe a 30 pound rate or 40 pound rate, something like that, of wheat, it basically, those two plants, super attractive to deer during the fall. And I realize that this may not be applicable to some other parts of the country, but in the South, I mean, those are really great plants, are well adapted, and they do really well. And the important thing is they're really attractive to deer. They're also really attractive to turkeys early in the breeding season when you're getting a lot of the strutting. You know, you'll see a lot of turkey use of those areas. And then they start to, the clover and the wheat starts to senesce. So it basically dies, right? Because those are annual plants. Mm-hmm. And when they die, because of the disturbance of the field, you start to get a lot of weeds come in. And if those weeds, if you take some care to make sure that you get rid of unwanted weeds, a lot of the weeds will be really high quality forbs. The things that you're trying to encourage in a brooding field. So what you end up with in that transition is it goes from that really high quality deer plot that becomes a really attractive turkey plot during a lot of folks' turkey season. And then it transitions early in brooding into a really good structure for brooding because of the weeds. What most people, well, there's multiple problems that come that most people are not taking care of. One, if you're planting something like that and you don't deal with whatever grass problems or sedge problems that you have, which is almost certain that you do, if you don't take care of those, that will limit it from transitioning into that kind of structure. And down here, that's ryegrass. Every field that I go to almost has a ryegrass problem unless they have tried to take care of it through some sort of herbicide regimen. So, you know, if you take care of some of your weed issues, which often is going to be some sort of grass, then, you know, it can transition. There can be some problematic forbs, don't get me wrong. We have plenty of them down here, you know, like sickle pod or you know, some of the other invasive forbs like that can certainly be a problem. But if you take some precautionary measures to make sure you deal with those issues and then let it transition into that forb-dominated community in the dead, you know, crimson and wheat, it can produce a really powerful system for you to balance deer hunting opportunity with turkey hunting opportunity with poult rearing cover. So like that's a practice that could really help people that have a property that they're interested in both species.
Now for folks who are doing like a fall planting and a spring planting kind of rotation on a food plot, what's the time period where you need to make sure you're leaving that plot alone so that it can act as that brooding habitat? Is that something that, there a window where we need to make sure we leave that?
That really, so there are resources available to you. And if you're a turkey enthusiast, you might already know this, but what you really need to figure out is where you are. When is peak nest initiation? So when are they incubating a nest, and then project to when the majority of hatching is going to occur. All right. So for a lot of the country, that might be the middle 2 weeks of May, for example, when poults are going to be just recently hatched, and they're going to be in that critical 2 week window. That window, where it, whatever it is for where you're listening from, is the critical window. The beauty of turkeys is it doesn't matter if you're in Oregon or Florida or Pennsylvania or Texas. It doesn't matter. The same general structure is needed. You might get there a little differently, but we need a forb-dominated community with a lot of bare ground underneath that. So, like you said, I had a video that I put on YouTube recently trying to show people that system, the crimson clover with wheat system, and what that needed to look like to make sure that it was producing that poult room cover. But if you can get that 2 week minimum, you know, period at a minimum, really, you know, a 4 to 6 week window of time, you can really produce a lot of poults. The other thing that I will add, a lot of those forbs that we're trying to produce in that system are 30% crude protein, 25% crude protein. They're just as good as what you would be planting for your deer, you know, summer plots.
Right.
In many cases. Yeah. So
it's a win-win.
Yeah, it really is. It's a great way to balance those two species. You know, a lot of the plants that deer are going to eat, the wild plants that they're eating when they're trying to support peak lactation or antler growth, are the same plants that are producing lots of insects for poults to run around under and catch.
Yeah. So habitat is the greatest way we can probably make a difference as an individual. Yep. By creating this kind of habitat, making sure that bottleneck is not a problem in our local areas. But there's also been a lot of talk within the turkey hunting community in recent years around, you know, how we influence turkey populations with our hunting itself. And you mentioned this on the top. Like, is there any kind of hunting pressure related impact that we're making? So again, back to what we as individuals can do. I know there's certain states, some states are starting to possibly pull back in some ways or adjust regulations in some ways. There's been lots of speculation about different tactics that we should not allow maybe, or different things like that. But from your perspective, based on what you've seen, based on the research, based on the folks you've talked to, if I am an individual who's worried about turkeys in my area, are there any changes that I should make as a turkey hunter, as far as how I hunt, as far as when I hunt, as far as anything like that? If I'm a concerned turkey hunter, are there any changes that I should be making to my hunting practices and or to the regulations that I advocate for that would help?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's one of the primary hypotheses that's being worked on, as I said earlier. So, you know, I think if you're worried about turkeys in your area, it makes sense for you to exercise some restriction, and maybe you want to decrease the harvest pressure that you have on your population. Another thing, in many places, it is still legal to shoot a hen, either in the fall or a bearded hen or something. That hen is the most important fact. She is playing the most important role in what the population trajectory is. You think about that hen, she is potentially producing nests and poults for 9 or 10 years, right? If you take out a hen, you've taken out years worth of nests and poults potentially. So, you know, that's another way that if you're concerned, you know, on your property, not take a hen. That makes sense. Some people have been concerned about the timing of hunting and when we're hunting. There is a study, and it's in the publication process now. It was in Tennessee, where they manipulated the timing of the season in one of the strongest experiments that's ever been done in turkeys. It was a before after control impact design. It's like the dream design, best case scenario. They had a really large sample size. They went into 5 counties and monitored the reproductive success and survival and all that stuff of populations of turkeys in these counties, and then took part of the counties after they did that for a while, 3 or 4 years. Then they changed the season date to be later in those counties, and then compared it to the other counties that they did not move it in. After they followed the populations for 2 more years, they looked to see, is there any difference in reproduction between the populations? And there was not. They didn't observe anything in Tennessee. But in that Tennessee study, they did show a substantial change in productivity of turkeys as a function of habitat. So hens that were nesting in shrubland had a substantially higher nesting success and than hens that nested elsewhere. And 7% of the landscape was between brooding and nesting cover considered high quality in that study. And almost 50% of the nesting attempts were in that 7%, right? That's substantial selection. And it conferred a really big effect on the success. And that's an example of where the selection is extremely strong for something that we could probably stand to produce a lot more on the landscape, certainly more than 7%. And if we did that at the scale, we'd have a really big effect on population. And here I think is the important thing. If you change your poult per hen ratio, so how many poults you're recruiting per hen, from let's say 1 to 4, you're so productive, all these other factors really don't matter that much.
And that's purely a function of habitat, right?
Not completely, but it's playing an incredibly important role, and it's probably affecting a lot of these other factors, like how important the hunt, like the hunting pressure on your property is strongly dependent on how many gobblers you're producing on your property. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you can increase that substantially, then it reduces the need for you to worry about the hunting pressure.
Right.
So, you know, I think that's really where the rubber meets the road. We need to figure out ways. Another thing that is really commonly practiced is people trap. And that I'm not discouraging people from doing that. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's a great way to get people involved in things. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the habitat should probably come first. And then if you want to also trap, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. If you're doing that within your legal right, then you go have fun. But, you know, the predator issue is probably linked to habitat first. And I think, you know, that's the way to think about that.
Yeah. So Marcus, if you were somehow elevated from your position at the University of Florida to instead become the turkey czar of the United States of America,
and you were granted
full access to the resources you would need and the regulatory powers you might want or need, if you had the magic wand, what would you do with that power over the next 10 years to right the ship when it comes to turkeys? I think we can all make some assumptions based on what you've been talking about here, but walk me through the biggest thing you would do when it comes to habitat, the biggest thing you would do when it comes to hunting or regulation, and if there's anything else in addition to those two categories, what would that be?
Yeah. Man, that's a tough one to answer. I think one thing that we have to do is we have to invest, and this is going to seem like a shameless self-promotion or something. We have to invest in research because research is an objective attempt to try to gain the information we need to make this decision, right? I think that's one thing we have to focus on. And, you know, when I'm painting with a broad stroke when I talk about habitat, there are probably some listeners out there that have been, you know, killing themselves on their property to improve habitat, and they may have exceptional habitat. That isn't what is on the landscape, but, you know, there are landowners that are already doing all this stuff. Like I've been on properties where I don't know what else they can do. You know, I think that's an important thing for you to consider, but trying to find ways to get that to scale up so that it is the norm on the landscape instead of an oddity is what we, you know, what we really need to get to. And I don't know, you know, if I'm in that situation, your czar situation, if that needs to be some sort of incentive or penalty. I don't think that's the way to do it. We don't respond well to that type right. of thing. But you know, we have responded well to incentive-based programs to get landowners to take actions that might otherwise not be in their self-interest, right? Like retiring some of the agricultural land so that it can better filter nutrients from getting into waterways. You know,
all those farm programs.
We incentivize things like that. So maybe some type of program that incentivizes people to create, better nesting and brooding cover could be a way to circumvent that. I know the research is necessary. Having some sort of modifier of behavior is probably a necessary point. And then the other part is awareness, trying to focus programming to reach people so that they're aware of the issue and they're aware of how to they can help with the issue. I think that's an important part of the puzzle there. So, I don't know exactly. I'd have to probably plan a little better than
that's fair.
Up here. But, I think those three elements would be pretty critical to trying to right the ship.
Yeah. So something.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Marcus, I should have set the stage better at the beginning of our conversation with this question, but I'll ask it now because late's better than never.
Okay.
I know you talked earlier that we're seeing anywhere from maybe 10% to 25% declines mm-hmm. across parts of the United States when it comes to turkey populations. Like how serious are those numbers? When you hear those numbers, to you, is that mm-hmm. like a 5-alarm fire drill? Like this is crisis mode? Or when we hear those numbers, is that like, well, yeah, this is concerning, but populations fluctuate. These things happen. This is something we need to be doing more research on, but let's not freak out. Like how concerned should we be? Is this, I guess on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being my hair's on fire. We should be really, really worried about what's going on. On a 1 to 10 scale, what's your concern level?
That's a great question. I have fluctuated on this. I think that we have cause for concern. We need to be aware. It has increased awareness. We're a passionate group of people that want to do what they need to do to help. They're willing to take some loss, whether that be an opportunity or if they need to put more into practices or whatever. I think that's great. It's also initiated a lot of research, which is really going to tell us the answer to your question, I think, is how concerned do we need to be? If it shakes out that this is a habitat issue, that could be an issue because it's hard to change at scale, right? We know how to do it. We don't know how to get it done, I think is the problem. And I'm more concerned if that's the issue because it's so hard to deal with at scale. I'm probably in the 6 or 7 range, I guess.
Okay.
Because I think there's more reason than not to be concerned. But I also I think we are seeing the things happen, like investment and research and outreach that we need, to figure out what's going on and figure out a way to fix it. And we've already demonstrated in many places that the community is willing to change seasons if that's what it takes, or they are willing to aggressively start managing habitat. We're seeing that in some places. People care about the resource, and that's why I'm not more concerned. I know that we have a group of people that we're ready to get this done. We just need to know what to do. So,
highly incentivized community. Yeah. So that is a good thing.
Yeah, and I get it. I mean, I am sitting here because of a turkey gobble. When I was a little kid, it was an experience with my dad hunting turkeys that set me on this path. So, you know, think about that when you're taking your kid. Like, it has made me dedicate my life to conserving this resource so that other people can have that opportunity.
So, so true. So important to remember that and keep that in mind. And can't beat that.
Yeah.
So Marcus, this has been I think for a lot of folks, a really helpful introduction to where things stand today with turkeys. For anyone who's been happily hunting them for years, but maybe hasn't been as tapped into the news or the science of things, this is a great primer. But I know there's going to be people listening to this who want more, who are interested in diving in deeper. And you've got the thing for people if they want that. Can you fill our listeners in on how they can connect with you and also get some more turkey know-how from your podcast and anywhere else?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. So I'm a co-host of the Wild Turkey Science podcast, and it's really it formed because there's concern about the species. We don't know what to do exactly, and it might vary based on where you're at. And there's all this research going on, and a lot of people, I'm guessing, that are listening might not even know that there's active research going on in their own state.
Yeah.
So the point of that podcast was not only to lay out what issues there are based on the published literature, but also connect people in near real time to the work going on in their state. We interview people from all over the U.S., a lot of researchers and wildlife biologists that are all focused on turkeys. And we have various topics. In fact, if you're interested in learning more, like I can't cover everything in an hour, right? But if you want some intense information on what you can do on your property to improve habitat or various other things, we have episode 29 and 30 on Wild Turkey Science. We talk about how to manage fields for brooding cover. It's probably the best resource out there. We had the best person in the business on the show to talk about it. And it's about the, you know, it will teach you how to make brooding cover in your fields. So we also have a YouTube channel. We put a lot of videos like the one you mentioned where we, you know, if you don't know what nesting cover looks like, we have a video that will show you what every hen was nesting in and what it looked like and whether or not she was successful. So, you know, there are resources through our YouTube channel at UF Deer Lab. I also have an Instagram account that I'm very active on, and I share all kinds of how-to type information and science that's going on, especially on turkeys. Occasionally, I share something about deer, but I focus a lot on turkeys. That's Dr. Disturbance. So I'd encourage you, if you're really interested in turkeys and you want to know how to manage them, or you want to understand the problem or what's going on in your state, you know, to tap into those resources, because that's what we're looking for, is to make it available to you all.
Yeah, I can't recommend those enough. I've been very impressed with the podcast and what you're sharing there in the YouTube channel as well. I've spent a pretty decent amount of time checking that stuff out, and there's a lot. So anyone who wants to dive in further, I have to second everything you said, Marcus. There's a wealth of information there for folks. So
yeah,
well, that all said, I just really appreciate you taking the time here on a Friday afternoon to regale me with our situation and to help, I think, point us all in a direction where we can learn more and be a part of the solution.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. Appreciate everybody out there.
All right. Thank you for tuning in. Appreciate you being here with us. Make sure you study up more on what Marcus is sharing over at the Wild Turkey Podcast. He has much, much more to share. I've genuinely enjoyed what I've learned from him. And when it comes to turkeys, I think we all just need to stay up to date on what's happening, continue to follow the research, and continue to find ways that we can make sure that we do the right things to keep turkeys around in the long term. So thank you for joining me. Until next time, stay wired to hunt.
outdoor adventure won't wait for engine problems. Things like hard starts, rough performance, and lost fuel economy are often caused by fuel gum and varnish buildup. Seafoam can help your engine run better and last longer. You simply pour a can into your gas tank. Hunters and anglers rely on Seafoam to keep their engines running the way it should the entire season. So pick up a can of Seafoam today at your local auto parts store or visit seafoamworks.com to learn more.
Market House has the cleanest, leanest, juiciest meat and seafood shipped to your home overnight. Expect the service of a local butcher and the convenience of a large supplier. Unlike many online butchers, you can grab just one meal's worth or lock in for a subscription box. Choose from grass-fed and grass-finished beef, American Wagyu, free-range poultry, grass-fed lamb, wild-caught king crab, seafood, and more.
For 15% off your first order, use code COUNTRY at checkout. Just visit markethouse.com.
That's MARKETHOUSE.com. And use the code COUNTRY.